Merry met, virtual traveller, and welcome to Stories from Lore, a podcast that invites you to rewild yourself through story by exploring nature, folklore, and the stories it inspires. My name is Dawn Nelson, and I'm an author and professional storyteller. The theme for this episode is wise old salmon, and so we're exploring the folklore, nature, and stories of the ever-resilient and persevering salmon. As many of you know, I usually start the podcast with some audio that explores the landscape and nature that I'm about to tell stories about. There are no salmon near me, though, unless you count the ones in the local fishmonger's counter. The Test River, which is not too far away and is a chalk stream, offers plenty of brown trout, but no salmon. So I couldn't go to a river where there were salmon, and I felt that a recording of me cooking and eating salmon was in bad taste, although I will be posting a delicious autumnal salmon recipe later in the month as a podcast extra. So, all things considered, I decided the best thing to do was to head out for a walk on my usual loop to find one of the fruits of autumn, the hazelnut. What's that got to do with salmon, though, you may ask? Well, join me on my walk and you'll find out. To excuse my shortness of breath as we walk up this hill. I've had a virus of some description, and it means that I'm finding it a little difficult to walk up a steep hill and chat to you, but we'll get there. So on my usual route, I walk a loop around the downland, which is just to the back of my house. I'm very lucky. And I start by walking up a lane, rather imaginatively, called Back Lane. I think it's rather wonderful as well. Is what it is, isn't it? A back lane. Now along this lane there are lots of trees, thankfully, still growing. There is chestnuts, and there's some oak further up. There are the witch elm, elven trees, and beech, lots of beech, and of course hazel. Now at this time of year, under your feet there's a carpet of a variety of different seeds, nuts and berries. There's no doubting the fact that autumn is here and the trees are starting to lose their fruits. Of course, one of these is hazelnuts. There's lots of them. Hazelnuts are really easy to identify. They come in a sort of star-like cup, green leaves, a bit spiky, look almost like a crown, like a lots of little crenellations. And within that is the hazelnut, which most of us will be able to identify. But in case you haven't seen a hazelnut before, it's slightly smaller than an acorn, similar size, has a white bit at the bottom where it's been attached to the crown that I was talking about, and a neat little point at the top, a little bit like a bishop's hat, bishop's mitre. So what have hazelnuts got to do with this month's episode? After all, I'm supposed to be talking about salmon, not hazelnuts. Well, hazelnuts are particularly important when it comes to salmon folklore, because they are linked to a story that comes from the Fiannan cycle, which involves the hero Finn McCool. Now I'll talk a little more about this story a bit later in the episode. But the hazelnuts come from 9 sacred trees which surround the Well of Wisdom in which the salmon swims. As the hazelnuts fall from these trees, these hazelnuts hold wisdom, intellect, knowledge and poetry, which I think is rather a lovely bit of mythology. They fall into the well, and as they do, the salmon note this, rise to the surface, and eat the hazelnuts, thus ingesting all of that wisdom and intellect and poetry, and they become salmon of wisdom, this particular one anyway. If you eat the salmon, then you too can inherit this wisdom. Now, the way to tell whether a salmon's been eating these hazelnuts, apparently, is because with each hazelnut it eats, a little tiny red dot appears on it. This might be a way of indicating when these salmon have reached maturity and when is a good time to eat them, perhaps. I don't know. It's just something to ponder. Often the folklore that we have in these stories actually teaches us how to live in balance with the world, so perhaps that's a way of showing when it's okay to eat the salmon, so not to eat them too young, because then you'll interfere with the reproductive cycle of the salmon and you'll end up with no salmon, which again I will talk about a bit later in this episode. So yeah, perhaps that's what our ancestors were doing. Either way, the salmon and the hazelnut are inextricably linked, and the salmon itself is one of the oldest creatures in our mythology and folklore of this country. Can you hear that? That's buzzards calling to each other. And a crow. Crows always like to get in on the act. I do wonder what they're saying to each other.
For the first 4 to 6 years of their lives, young salmon live in rivers. Their bodies then go through a change which allows them to live in salt water, and it is then that they head out to sea. This process within their body is called smoltifying. Their migration to the sea happens between March and June. They spend a year in the ocean before returning to the rivers any time between November and February in order to breed. Their epic journey from the sea to the rivers where they were born is legendary, and their ability to leap into the air and propel themselves 3 metres upstream is apparently where they get their name from, although that in itself is a leap. Salmon is thought to come from the Old English word salmon, which derives from the Anglo-Norman and Old French word salmon, which in turn comes from the Latin salmo, which potentially has its root in the word salire, which is to leap. I don't know about you, but now all I can think about is Tolkien's Sauron, who will now in my mind forever be a misunderstood salmon. At the end of their epic journey, the females lay their eggs in depressions in the riverbed called reds, and the eggs are fertilised by the male salmon in these dips in the riverbed. Sadly, wild salmon are on a steep decline, and it is thought that climate change and overfishing are the most likely culprits. Due to changes in the ocean conditions, only around 5% of salmon ever return to their riverbed breeding grounds. It is thought that in the next 30 years, and that's potentially within my lifetime and certainly within the lifetime of my daughter, Atlantic salmon may well become extinct in many areas of the world. Lindsay Rapson, who works with the Missing Salmon Alliance, a group of trusts, conservation and fisheries organisations, says, "Salmon represents the global health of our rivers, oceans, and ultimately our relationship with the natural world that sustains all human activity." Salmon has been extremely significant within British and European culture, and it still is for many cultures. For indigenous cultures such as Native Americans and the Ainu of Japan, the salmon is vital to their survival, providing an invaluable food source. For these people, the salmon is revered and respected. Perhaps this was once so for Western cultures, before so many of us lost touch with where our food actually comes from. At sea, the salmon was considered an unlucky animal, along with several others, and should not be mentioned on board a ship. Instead, sailors referred to it as the beast with the scales. In Irish folklore, it is said that a black salmon is the soul of someone who has drowned, which I think points to an interesting link to the unlucky at sea, perhaps. In a story, hailing from Mulroy Bay on the coast of County Donegal, Ireland, salmon, or rather lying about them, bring two men some very bad luck. They are out fishing and have caught two large salmon when Saint Columba appears and asks them if they have had any luck catching salmon. They lie as they do not wish to share their catch with him. Apparently he's a bit notorious for wanting food from people. His reply is to tell them that if they are telling the truth, they will now catch many salmon. If they are lying, though, they will never catch another salmon in the bay again. Legend has it, they never did. In Scotland, salmon are associated with the River Shin. Here, a few miles from the river's mouth, there are the Falls of Shin, and salmon can be seen completing their journey with famous leaps here. It is said that the river never freezes. The stories in the Christian religion tell that it was once blessed by Christ, who took pity on the salmon who would otherwise have been caught out by the frozen waters. In the city of Glasgow, also in Scotland, the coat of arms contains two salmon. The story goes that a local king once gave his wife a ring as a symbol of their love. She gave it to another man, and unbeknownst to her, the king saw this. He took it from the queen's lover whilst he slept and threw it into the River Clyde. The king then asked his queen if he might see the ring, which of course she no longer had. No soldier could find it for her, and so she appealed to St. Kentigern. In a most fruitful fishing trip, he found it inside a salmon and returned it to the queen, who was absolved of all guilt. Hence the salmon on the coat of arms have rings balanced on their noses. Throughout Celtic folklore and mythology, the salmon is very often connected to wisdom. This is due to several stories of wise salmon. The salmon of Clyn Clew is described as the oldest and wisest of all animals and aids Arthur's men in their search for Prince Mabon. One of the most famous appearances of wise old salmon is in a legend that tells of how there was a salmon who dwelt in the Well of Wisdom, known as Tobar Seges. As I mentioned in my hazelnut hunting, this salmon ate the hazelnuts that fell from the Tree of Wisdom. This salmon features in one of the stories from the Fiannan cycle, which tells of the brave warrior Finn McCool and how he came to accidentally ingest the knowledge this salmon held. The story goes that the druid Finnegas had spent many years, some records say 7 years, trying to catch the salmon in the well. When he finally did, he planned to cook it so that he may eat the salmon and inherit all its knowledge. He left his apprentice, or in some cases his servant, Finn McCool, to cook the fish, and told him that under no circumstances should he eat it. As Finn was cooking the fish, the skin on the fish blistered, and either the blister pops itself or Finn pops it, and hot oil spits out and onto his thumb. His reflex is to put his thumb in his mouth, and thus he ends up ingesting all the knowledge the salmon had within it in that one drop of scalding fat. On his return, Finnegas immediately saw the knowledge that now lived within Finn. He could see it radiating from within him, and he demanded to know what had happened. Finn told him what had happened, and as a result, Finnegas gave Finn the rest of the salmon, knowing that no wisdom would come to him from that fish, and that that knowledge now belonged to Finn McCool. As a result, every time Finn needed to work out a problem, he could stick his thumb in his mouth, and it would give him all of the knowledge and wisdom that used to be within that salmon. This story is very reminiscent of the story of Ceridan's Cauldron, or Taliesin, as it is also known. I tell this story frequently, and it's one of my favourites, and it also involves a salmon. This time, the salmon is a shapeshifter. Gwion, in his efforts to escape Ceridan, turns himself into a strong swimming salmon, hoping to evade capture, but Ceridan, as an otter, is no match for him, and the chase continues. If you want to hear the whole of that story, you can find it on my YouTube channel. Just search for DD Storyteller and it's there. All of this shapeshifting brings us to one of the most famous of the Norse gods, Loki. Now initially for this episode, I was going to tell you the story of Finn McCool, which I have mentioned several times during the episode. However, it occurred to me that The Binding of Loki is also an excellent tale featuring a salmon, no pun intended. It also makes for an ironic addition to this episode, as Loki is far from wise in this story, but I hope you'll enjoy it all the same. This recording is taken from a live show that I did online. It's quite a dark Norse myth. So if there are younger members of your household listening, you may want to listen through to it first before you share it with them. So, there is a great sadness in Asgard, shall we say. Within the great hall where they all feast and drink, where there is normally beership, which is the old English word for exactly that, drinking together, there is not a lot of that going on. They're all grieving for the loss of Balder, and they all know who is to blame. Loki has gone too far this time. But they have not banished him from the hall. They have not sent him away. It's actually quite difficult to do with Loki. No, he's just sort of hanging around, like the proverbial bad smell. And in that hall, where they all sat eating and drinking, there is very little joy. Very little celadrim, which is hall joy. And there is no dremcraft, which is music. And Loki has been sat watching all the gods, reminiscing over their time with Balder, mourning his loss, and just generally, as far as Loki's concerned, being very unreasonable and boring. Because after all, it was really rather a good trick, wasn't it? Surely they had him around to entertain them. And that's what Loki had done. It's not a lot different from pelting him with things. I mean, he'd been asking for it, surely. Loki's been sitting there for some time now, watching the grief of the gods. And he's bored, he's fed up, and he wants them to start singing and dancing and playing music again. He wants the joy back in Asgard. So he stands up and he says, "What's wrong with you all? Balder wasn't all that. There's plenty of others. We still got Idun's apples. Odin, you've got a 8-legged horse that goes faster than any other horse in the nine worlds. Thor, you still got your hammer of justice. I haven't taken away all your toys. It's just Balder." "Loki," says Odin, "you've gone too far. Sit yourself down." "No," says Loki, "I will have joy once more in this hall. I will have singing. Come on, I'll sing us a song." Odin looks at Loki, but Loki does not take that as a warning. So he starts to sing. "Thialfi was slaved and Thor was married. It's jolly good fun to see Thor as a maid. Remember that time Kaffisir was turned to wine? Well, that's why they call me Loki. Of all the adventures in all the nine worlds, whether you're a god or a thrall or a churl, you'll always find me causing mischief and glee, and that's why they call me Loki. Loki, you've gone too far," said Thor. He stood up and he raised his hammer. "You are Simbolwalank, Loki," which is a rather wonderful word for mead arrogant. "What?" said Loki. "You have gone too far, Odin told you. You will leave this place, Loki." "I am not Simbolwalank. I've had just as much as the rest of you. I am Simbolweary. I am tired of you lot. I am fed up. I'm fed up of the Loki. Where's Idun's apples? Loki, what have you done with Sif's hair? Loki, what are we going to do about this giant that's building this wall? How are you going to fix that? It's always me that has to sort it out, isn't it? That's because it's usually you that's caused the problem," said Thor. "You see how it is. You just have me around for entertainment, I'm pretty sure. And that's why you keep me around. Well, I'd be careful, Loki, because we might not want to keep you around for much longer. I suggest you leave us." Well, Loki knew when he was beat. And whilst he was a trickster and sometimes a little foolish, not stupid. No. And so he did. He left that hall with his tail between his legs. He went up to a little house that he had made himself for just such an occasion, when he knew that he was not safe, that all the gods had taken it against him, and that there was no way that he could make this good again. This little house had four doors on it, so that he could see who was coming from any direction. He took himself up to that house, he lit himself a fire, he poured himself some more mead, and he muttered to himself about how they didn't know how good they had got it, and that if Loki was to disappear, they'd definitely miss him. Surely they would miss him just as much as they missed Balder. Balder was no good anyway. All he was a pretty face. I mean, really? Not really missed, is he? He got to thinking what he was going to do if the gods really did decide that he had gone too far and that they were going to do something about him. Thought about it. He thought, well, he's a shapeshifter. I can shapeshift into whatever I like, he thought. There's a wonderful stream running right the way down the mountain and a great big black deep pool underneath the waterfall. I can change myself into a salmon and I can hide right down at the bottom of it. He spent all night thinking about how he could just become a salmon and disappear down into the bottom of this pool. And he was so entranced by the flames and the mead and his wonderful idea that he'd come up with that he didn't notice that hanging beside the fire in his house was a net, which he had made for the sole purpose of catching fish in that little stream. In fact, he didn't notice the net until he heard voices outside, the voices of the gods. They had indeed decided that they were going to come and sort Loki out. They were going to put pay to him once and for all. And he could hear them talking about how they were going to take him back to wherever it was he didn't really want to hear, and they were going to sort him out. And as he was looking up to see which direction they were coming from, he saw that net. He thought, if I change myself into a salmon, well, they'll be able to use the net to catch me. And he threw it on the fire. And then he left, ran down the hill, down the opposite side to the direction the gods were coming in, changed himself into a strong, lithe salmon, and plunged down into that deep, dark pool beneath the waterfall. And there he waited. He couldn't really hear what the gods were saying because the sound was distorted through the water, but he knew who was there. He knew Thor was there. He could hear Thor with the great big thundering footsteps. And he knew that Thor would probably have brought his hammer of justice, not that that would be any good underneath the water. He also heard Kvasir, who had made a miraculous reanimation out of the mead. Kvasir was there, and Thor and Heimdall and Odin and, you know, all the names. They were looking for him. They shouted out, Loki, it's no use hiding. You come out and take what's coming to you. Loki was not going to come out and take what was coming to him. He figured if he could stay underneath that waterfall for long enough, well, they would cool off a bit. Well, where is he? Where is he, Heimdall? I don't know, says Heimdall. I wasn't at the end of the Bifrost, so I didn't see everything on this occasion. I don't know where he is. Well, Kvasir, where is he? Come on, you're the guy with all the wisdom and all the knowledge. You must know where he is. I don't see everything like Heimdall does, but I tell you what, I have seen something in this house which does make me think that he might be out there somewhere in that river. River, said Thor. Was he doing it? Well, I didn't see him in the river. No. Look, in the fire and in the ashes, they could see a grid of a net that had been burnt, the one that Loki had thrown on there. I think he's decided to turn himself into a fish, said Kvasir. How'd you work that out, said Thor? Come on, please, do tell. Well, why else would he burn the net if only to stop us catching something in it? And that would be a fish. Oh, said Thor. Right. Well, that's no problem. I'm very good at catching fish. I think we're going to need everybody for this, said Kvasir. And so they did all join together. They made a new net. They spent the day making the net out of nettles, creating a new net. They went down to the river where Loki had just been skulking around in the bottom of that pool, quite oblivious to all the industry that had been going on above in his little four-door house. They stood at one end opposite the Blackpool, and they thought that if they put the net right down, they would be able to catch him as he came across. He saw all of the feet in the water of all the different gods. He could tell who they were, definitely could tell who Nord was there. He could definitely tell his feet. But that's another story, isn't it? Now, as he watched them put the net down, he could see that there were some stones there and there was a little gap that he could swim through. And so it was that he went to swim for it. And just as he was about to do it, they saw what he was doing. They saw this enormous salmon. There he is, they saw, he's just there. And so they lowered the net down. They could see what was about to happen. And so Loki had no other choice but to leap up and try and leap over the net. Well, of course, Thor, even though he is big, strong, he is still quick. He's a god. And as this salmon came up out of the water, he grabbed hold of the end of that salmon and squeezed hard on the end of Loki's tail because he had no care for Loki anymore. If a salmon could have squealed, Loki did. And they do say that Thor pulled so hard on the end of that salmon that that's why all fish have this dip at the end of their tails. But I'll let you decide whether that's true or not. They put the fish out onto the bank, thrashing around as Loki was, and they put that net over the top of him so that he would stay still. And of course, eventually, Loki had to turn himself back into his god form, his human form. There was nothing else he could do, otherwise, he would have suffocated. They wrapped him up in that net, and Loki knew now he submitted to these gods. He knew now that he was not going to escape, and they would have to take whatever fate it was that they had decided was coming for him. And believe you me, it's quite a fate. They carried Loki down the hill in the net, kicking and screaming occasionally, just, giving it a go to see if he could escape. They carried him down until they got to the valley, and they walked along the valley until they got to a deep, dark cave. They went into the cave. And there they found some enormous rocks, which they placed down with slime and mold and stalactites and all sorts on these rocks, placed them down on the ground in the cave. There was a drip, drip, drip from the top of the cave. Constant drip, drip, drip. It was dank. It was dark. The only things that Loki would have in that cave would be bats and beetles and bugs, and not a lot of conversation. What else was in that cave? Was Loki's wife, Sigyn, and his sons, Narfi and Vali. They had been made to come to the cave by the gods to watch Loki's fate. What should we do with them now? Said Thor. Well, I think, said Odin, that he should be made to watch his son die too, just as I was made to. There was not an inch of compassion left in Odin. Very well. And so it was that the gods turned Vali into a wolf, and Wolf turned on his brother Narfi and ripped him to pieces. It was not a sight that anyone should have to watch. And there were Sigyn and Loki, unable to do anything. And when his guts lay strewn about the cave, the wolf howled at what it had done, for there was still a tiny bit of Vali in there. And he ran out of the cave and was never seen again. The gods took those up to 15 meters of intestine, apparently. He took those intestines and they wrapped them around Loki and bound him to those stones that they had laid in the bottom of the cave. But that was not enough. For Loki then heard footsteps coming into the cave. This time it was the giantess Skadi. And if there is anybody that Loki has wronged the most, it is definitely Skadi. She brings with her an enormous snake, and she hangs this snake from the ceiling, not so that it can reach Loki at all, but just so that it is over his face, so that the venom from the fangs of that snake will drip, 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 drip onto Loki's face. They will land in his eyes, and it's searing pain every time it does. Sigyn, who has lost two sons and now has a husband bound in his own son's intestines with a snake hanging above him, has no choice but to take a bowl and sit beside him and hold that bowl underneath the snake so that the venom drips into the bowl. The gods, satisfied that Loki is going nowhere and that he will be forever punished, they leave. And Sigyn is left in the darkness with Loki, with the drip, 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 drip. And every time that bowl gets too full, she has to take it away to pour the venom out away from Loki. And one drop falls down from the snake and lands in Loki's eye once more. And the searing pain means he howls out. And there he stays with Sigyn until the day to end all days, Ragnarok. Thanks for joining me for this stream-leaping, god-binding episode. For more folklore and stories, you can subscribe to my Substack. Just hop on over to the Substack site and search for Ceridwen's Cauldron, or use the link in the show notes. You can upgrade to paid for just £5 a month for an extra dose of wild storytelling to your inbox. Either way, signing up as a paid or free subscriber is much appreciated and helps to support the podcast and my work with folklore and story. For this episode, extras will include a recipe for an autumnal salmon dish, a written version of the folklore included in this podcast, and a link to a Spotify playlist which includes a variety of fishy-themed music. As well as Substack, you can find me on Instagram as @DeeDee_storyteller and on Facebook as DeeDee Storyteller. I hope to see you there, as I'd love to tell you another story. Until next time, toodle-pip!